Good morning. As we begin our class this morning, similar to what Brother David did, I'm going to also offer an overview and introduction to this class, which I would tell you is concerns itself with very high thoughts, very lofty thoughts. It's a very, very big subject. We're not yet through the whole subject, actually, of Genesis 1 through 3. Primarily, I'm going to say in Genesis 1 and 2, and just make comments on Genesis 3. But I want to make some introductory comments in regard to this subject, because it's important to realize. Number one, because the subject is a very complex one, believe it or not, and one that requires a lot of thought, I don't want to lose anybody here in terms of doing the academics. And you say, well, this is all well academic, because I'm going to try very hard to weave into this whole class the application to us and how this really affects us in looking at Genesis 1 and 2 in particular. Number two, things that we're going to talk about here, it's really hard to be dogmatic on things. And I think the problem we see at times is people say, well, you're up at the stand, what you're saying must be exactly the way it is, and I challenge what you say. Well, in this class, it's real easy to challenge what I say, because we're dealing with such high thoughts here, such lofty ideas when it comes to creation and what's being talked about here in Genesis 1 and 2. And you'll find that there's so much inside these first two chapters that I don't think we've fully appreciated, that it's really hard at times to get your hand around it and say, well, it must be like this or it must be like that. And so there's a lot of things that we need to look at in terms of that. So if you hear something from the stand and say, oh, I never heard that before, and the answer is, yeah, you probably never did. And so therefore, it's up to you to go and think about those things. And that's really what I'm going to try to get you to do, is look at these concepts and say, does this seem to fit into what we see? So as we go through this, and I hope I want to read this quote here. And by the way, Mr. Einstein and Mr. Newton will be joining us this week, because they have some interesting things to say, I think, in bearing on Genesis 1 and 2. So let's read this. Einstein says, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom the emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. The insight into the mystery of life, coupled though it be with fear, has also given rise to religion. To know what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which our dull faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This is knowledge. This is feeling at the center of true religiousness. Now, you don't think of Einstein as a religious person. He probably really isn't. Although certainly Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, who we're going to talk about, is much more into the religious side of this. But these two gentlemen help us, or at least we're going to try to help us, form a basis for what we're going to study this week. As a real quick thing here, you might want to take out a piece of paper. I did this once a long time ago for a young people's class, but I thought it was interesting. I would like you to have a piece of paper, take a pen, and quickly, if you will, jot down what happened each day of creation. Now, the seventh day I'll give you. I think it's an easy one. So just write down in order what happened on the first 6 days of day one, day two, write down none of those. What took place? And while you're doing that, I'll just make some comments in that it's very interesting that when we look at Genesis 1 and 2, the assumption we make is that, oh, it's just about the creation, and I already know what that is, and I can just skip through those two chapters, and that it doesn't have a great deal of impact on me. But it's interesting how you think you know something, and maybe you don't. Okay, if you've had some time, I'll let you continue on while I bring up for you the class goals here that you'll see up on the board. One is, of course, an appreciation of the Lord God himself. Because when you look at creation and look what God has done in setting up the world as we know it, and where we are. It is absolutely stunning. I mean, it's a really an amazing thing that when you really stop and contemplate what's being written in those first two chapters, there's a foundational nature of these first three books. What's interesting, and we're going to talk about the third part about paradigms and all, things that Jesus and Paul and Peter say really take you back to Genesis 1 and 2. If you don't understand these first two chapters, it's sometimes very difficult to understand what's being said later on in your Bible, because there's going to be comments made, and you're going to say, well, why is he saying it like that? And it's because he's bringing you back to these first two chapters. And I think that's a very important point to make. I'd also make the point that even as John's revelation that he was given talks about the future, that the revelation given to Moses on the mountain was a revelation in the past. Israel, as we'll see, there were some elements of oral history that were passed down about the creation. But I suggest to you that even up to Moses' day, there was no real, obviously there was no written revelation of what really took place, how God actually created everything. And so there was a lot of, interpretation of how things happened. So I think that's important. And finally, what we're going to try to do in this class is try to also give you other areas of study. So we're going to deal in particular, in a lot more detail, days 2, 4, and 6. That doesn't mean the other days are unimportant. I want to look more deeply at that. As we get later in the week, I'm going to kind of give you like what I would like to call little short stories. And the short stories are studies you can go do on your own. The problem with this subject is it's so big and so vast that you tend to get into you tend to get what I call a rabbit hole. You start going this way, and then suddenly you start veering off in that way. Pretty soon you're down in some other area that's very interesting, and then you got to come back to where you are. So you want to keep these thoughts in mind as we go through our class. So again, like I said, we're going to look at those day two, the physical creation, the order of things, and the implications. And when I say implications, I mean our New Testament you'll look at things like I did. You look at things now a lot differently to some extent of what Jesus is saying and what the apostles are saying about certain things that you look at in a certain way. Day four, about the creation of what happened there, and I'm sure you wrote down it was the sun, moon, and stars on day four. And we'll see what that all means in terms of it. And, of course, what I call a busy day six. If you've never considered it, if you look at what happens on day six, there's a lot of stuff going on there. And we want to evaluate what actually is going on in that sense. Now, observationally, and I'm just going to make this a general observation before we get it. If you look at Genesis 1 and 2, there are implications even for ourselves in our lives. For instance, the Lord God created this earth and the heavens that we see and everything that's around us with a thought in mind. He starts with an idea, with a thought. And he creates now. He comes to the angel and says, I want this, I want that, I want this. All of it begins with a thought in mind. And this is a really important point for us, which are his creation. In your life, and in my life, the quality of our lives depend on our thoughts. What we think is what we become. Your physical reality is only a reflection of what your inner thoughts were. Now, that sounds like it may sound like a foreign concept, but it's really true. Many ways you're living your life, and we won't go very deep into this, inside out. The world around you is shaped by your thoughts. And so people like to say, no, my thought, the way I am is because of this influence and that person. And all. No, no, it actually starts inside you and works its way out. And you'll see that as we go through this week, how that plays out. But just remember, if you look around in your life, you say, I don't really like what I see around in my life. Well, just remember that that's been directed by what you thought. So, the bottom line is, you want to change your life? Change your thoughts. Things will definitely change. Here's one of the gentlemen, of course. I had hair like that in high school, by the way. So Isaac Newton, very interesting guy. We talked about him, I'm sure, before. He was a professor in a Trinitarian college. Of course, he didn't believe in the Trinity. And so his writings, especially there, were very much hidden in terms of his understanding of that. Newton, of course, as you know, is going to come up with a theory of gravity. And we'll talk about that more. We're going to have a video to show you later, which we'll close with today. But Newton's an interesting guy because he talks and thinks about the nature of God, how things are set up. He's very interested in the orbit of the planets. He's very much, and he sees the connection between a divine being, an immortal being, an intelligent design to all this. And without that premise, it's very hard for him to reach the conclusion that he reaches. So when we introduce him as the father of gravity, and of course many talk about the father of physics and things like that, it's important to see what he's done and how that really has an influence on us. And just an aside here, and again, I'm trying not to be too academic on this. So in his understanding of God, he is what we would call an Arian. That's A-R-I-N. Which we are, by the way, in our understanding of God, Arian. Which also, if we're looking at churches around today, Jehovah's Witnesses would be Arian. And that particular belief system of one God, not a triune God, has gotten a lot of pushback down through history. The idea that there is no equal three-in-one, as they call it. And so Newton kind of hid that for reasons of staying on as a professor and things like that. That doesn't mean, though, he didn't have followers who agreed with him and wrote on that subject. We'll see that in a minute. This gentleman, I might have had hair in the morning like that, but this gentleman actually comes along as a young man working in a patent office. That's all he's doing. And he's going to come up with a grand scheme of the universe. And so with Einstein coming along, as we'll see, the two of them, the two great thinkers, if you will, of the universe, Einstein and Newton, are going to kind of clash in their thinking. If you didn't already know, Einstein went on to become what they consider, I think it was mentioned in the stand, became like a rock star. He really was. He was very popular. Once he developed his theory of relativity, the world just flocked to him waiting for some grand new idea. But when it comes to Einstein, his thoughts on this subject help us. Now, he's not talking religious, but you'll see in the context of Genesis 1, he really is talking about that. This gentleman, his name is, you won't believe that, Isaac Newton Vale. Is his name. His mom and dad decided that Newton would be a good name to throw in the middle of Isaac. Isaac Newton Vale lived in the 1800s. And he is going to propose an idea, which we'll look at probably more closely tomorrow, about the physical creation of Genesis 1. And he's got a theory, which, by the way, a lot of people have accepted this theory, others not so much. But we're going to challenge his theory against Newton and Einstein and all the other. And what we're trying to see is how God laid out the universe, if you will, from Genesis 1. You'll see later this has scriptural and spiritual value to us, because God does everything in a design. Everything is laid out in order and in a perfect pattern, and it's really important. So that's another person that we're going to talk about. This person is Samuel Clarke, and we'll get to him in just a moment, because Samuel Clarke, who was a contemporary with Sir Isaac Newton, wrote down several things about the nature of God, which is interesting to us, as you'll see, only because his writings were picked up by John Locke, who you may not know, was a famous British writer, who in turn, that was picked up by Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, and of course, then moves its way down through even our American history. In terms of the nature of God. And I think that you'll find to be interesting. If you look at the overview of Genesis 1, you see things that are, I don't want to say strange, but interesting. You see that God places a lot of things in the Bible, in Genesis 1. He places man in a garden. He places the planets in place. He places it night and day. He names things. There's a lot of naming going on. Adam gets involved later with naming things. All those general concepts come into play here as we look at both the physical universe and also how we fit into that, and how Jesus and the disciples and the apostles are bringing us back to the foundation. I would also suggest to you that what we see in Genesis 1-2 is a bookend of Revelation at the end of John's apocalypse. The two of them are like bookends, if you will, of our Bibles, because both are leading you back to a place of fellowship with God. It's everything kind of goes in a big circle here. Anyway, I want to address this this gentleman here on what he had to say. Now, for the purpose of the tape, I'm just going to read this. Of course, you can read it on your own. But some of what he says, I'm going to stop because there, and believe it or not, there are people who challenge some of the thoughts that you see here on the nature of God. And I think this is really important for us to look at. Here's what he says. He says, here's some of the points. That this being must have existed from eternity. And that if he existed from eternity, that he is immutable and an independent being. And that immutable, independent being, which existed from eternity, is without any external cause. Now, that is something we're not going to get our heads around at all. God always is. We don't know where God came from. And the author here is making that very point. We know he came from... he had no external cause. He was. He is. And that's a very, very high concept. What the substance or essence of that being is, which is self-existent or necessarily existing, we have no idea. Neither is it at all possible for us to comprehend. We have no idea the substance of God. We have no concept that we as mortals, we're not even going to try to do any of that. That through the substance or essence of this existent, self-existent being, being absolutely incomprehensible to us, yet many of the essential attributes of his nature are strictly demonstrable as well as his existence, and in the first place, he must of necessity be eternal. What he's basically saying is, God is from ever to ever. He must necessarily be the supreme being. As he says here in number six here is surprisingly controversial. That this being must of necessity be infinite and omnipresent. That God dwells everywhere, in all of time, forward and backward, everywhere. He is present everywhere. Now, this concept is at first we sit there, well, of course, who would ever argue that? But you'll see in a moment that people argue this point. One of the things, and I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but if you're interested in this subject about time, time is relative to us. How relative time is to God, since he dwells in all time, is a much different subject. If you're interested in that subject, there's a fictional book out, but I'm sorry, it's called Einstein's Dreams, and it attempts to show in different chapters what happens if time were to vary in your life. Let's say time worked in a certain way different than what our linear time is in our lives. But when it comes to this concept, omnipresent turned out to be a problem for people. You'll see what I mean in a minute. Of course, this being must be one. He must be an intelligent being, must not be a necessary agent, but being endued with liberty and choice. Now, that's an interesting comment about the nature of God that we might look at, that we say we have free will, and sometimes we like to say, well, no, God can't do this. God can't do that. We want to put limits on the Father, but we don't want to have limits on us. We say, we have free choice. We have liberty, so to speak, to do things. God has that same ability to make choices. And I want to examine that later on in our class too, and we'll see it certainly in Genesis 2, that God likewise gets to make choices like we make choices, and he has perfect free will to do whatever he wants. Obviously, infinite power, infinitely wise, and of course his nature must be goodness, justice, and truth, and all other moral perfections, such as the supreme governor and judge of the world. In other words, God is good. He's not an evil God, but a good God. Now, he was a student, if you will, of Sir Isaac Newton, who would have supported all of what you see here. Let's talk for a moment about omnipresent. So there was a person there at the time who laughed at this idea and said, so here's what you're telling me. You're telling me that God created this universe, set things into motion, but now has to be present to make sure things are working just right. Why didn't he just set it up and walk away from it? Like perpetual motion. He doesn't need to be around. In other words, yeah, wind up the clock, you set it there, and it just starts working. And there's no reason for the Lord to be present there. And if he's present everywhere, not just here, but in the universe, everywhere present, why he's all powerful. Just set it in motion and let it fly. And so the argument bears on that point that there's no need for God to be everywhere at all times. And we're going to see that subject get challenged along the way too. We'll come back to this video in just a moment, but I want you to consider some of the things, mysteries, if you will, of Genesis 1 and 2. For instance, Newton says that God was a rational God. Is God rational? Did he give us the ability to be rational? And what does it mean to be rational in our lives? Notice here that, I don't know if you've not noticed it or not, day 2 is the only day that God says is not very good. In fact, he says nothing about day 2. Why is that? That seems like an odd statement. You're reading Genesis 1, God said, and he looked and everything was very good. It's day 2, he says, nothing. Let's go on day 3, that's very good, day 4, on down. And that seems like an oddity of why day 2 stands out as being different. Better yet, the first time God says something is not good shows up in Genesis 2, right? He says, it's not good for the man to be alone. But then some real odd things happen. You know, the animals come. Adam's going to name them looking for a helpmate. Surprisingly, can't find a helpmate. And so it begs the whole question of why that whole thing took place. God knew that the animals aren't going to be helpmates for this man. But yet, this all happened. Adam named him, doesn't find a helpmate, and voila, we're at where we're at. And that's, of course, a rather strange mystery to look at. God gave each one of us special things, imagination, ideas, thoughts. The way in which, by the way, if you look at Genesis 1, and from the standpoint that the Elohim were involved, you'll notice that when you get to day 6, God says we're going to work together. And I suggest to you, as we get to that subject, it's because the angels had never created a man before. So when God says, let us make a man, God says, you're going to need help with this. This is a different situation. This is not your creating of cattle and things of this nature. It's a whole different subject. And so he introduces the idea that we as a creation are very unique. And certainly, if we're very unique, certainly the creation of woman, likewise, is very unique in all of what God has done. And that subject in itself is a rather interesting thing to look at. God is light. Now, we're not going to talk so much about day 1. I'm going to make just a general observation. Day 1, we'll not talk much more in it. My suggestion, I think I've even mentioned here from this stand in the past, is that God came across the earth in a decayed situation, said this is not acceptable, and that it's dark, the globe is filled with water, and says this is not acceptable, we're going to restore it back the way it was, and he starts doing that whole restoration process. How earth got into that situation, I'm not going to say. And I don't know. Others would, of course, disagree with that. So I say I'm not being dogmatic here. Others would say, no. The earth started exactly 6,000 years ago, and that's just the way it was. The earth was without form and void. And I find that a little hard, only because it's hard to imagine God creating something without form and void and just being dark, and then saying, oh, look, I've got a problem. Well, no, it fell into that position. How that happened, we don't know. But we do know that God decided that he would take something that was in ruin and restore it back. And that's the whole story of man, too, taking us who are of sin nature and restoring us back to a divine nature. It's a very nice picture of the Father, pretty much what Samuel Clark was saying earlier, which is that God is essentially good and just and kind, and he doesn't want to lose things. So he, rather than just like the old throwaway things, he stays with it and says, no, I can make this better. And of course, that's the entire working premise here of that. We're going to talk a little bit about the idyllic state of the man and woman in the garden and how, of course, they came to the fall. And when we stop and conceive all of what God's plan is, we're going to see within this framework that there's much deeper purposes for the way Genesis 1 and 2 are laid out and the way that God is operating. He's operating, the whole plan of salvation operates from Genesis 1 and 2 and goes forward from there. This isn't just an academic thing. It really has a big effect on us. So I want you to really kind of see where we're at in terms of this sort of a judgment idea here. There are, of course, this idea of the universe itself. Well, rather than doing it at the end of class, we may just do this now, this particular video that's going to come up. Let me just kind of set this up for you. This comes from a video. It's on YouTube, but it's actually a much longer one called The Elegant Universe. And it this particular segment talks about how Einstein and Newton have a problem. Or really, Einstein had the problem because the two of them had concepts that came opposite of each other. They didn't agree. As you watch this video, and it goes on for like 10 minutes, what I'm getting you want you to see here is more concept of what's going on and how this has a relation to what we see in Genesis 1. And it's a very important subject because when we start in, and Lord willing, we'll start in tomorrow with day 2, you'll see how these concepts begin to play out, how things begin to work, if you will, on this. So let's watch this. And I'm almost afraid to take the headset off, but I'm going to give it a try here. So let's see if this will work. And I apologize, the quality of this at the beginning is not quite as good as you'd like. Or at least what I would like. Can everyone hear that?
And long before Einstein, the quest for unification began with the most famous accident in the history.
Oops.
As the story goes, one day in 1665, a young man was sitting under a tree when all of a sudden he saw an apple fall from above. And with the fall of that apple, Isaac Newton revolutionized our picture of the universe. In an audacious proposal for his time, Newton proclaimed that the force pulling apples to the ground and the force keeping the moon in orbit around the Earth were actually one and the same. In one fell swoop, Newton unified the heavens and the Earth in a single theory he called gravity.
The unification of the celestial with the terrestrial, that the same laws that govern the planets in their motions govern the tides and the falling of fruit here on Earth. It was a fantastic unification of our picture of nature.
Gravity was the first force to be understood scientifically, though three more would eventually follow. And although Newton discovered his law of gravity more than 300 years ago, his equations describing this force make such accurate predictions that we still make use of them today. In fact, scientists needed nothing more than Newton's equations to plot the course of a rocket that landed men on the moon. Yet, there was a problem. While his laws described the strength of gravity with great accuracy, Newton was harboring an embarrassing secret. He had no idea how gravity actually works. For nearly 250 years, scientists were content to look the other way when confronted with this mystery. But in the early 1900s, an unknown clerk working in the Swiss patent office would change all that. While reviewing patent applications, Albert Einstein was also pondering the behavior of light. And little did Einstein know that his musings on light would lead him to solve Newton's mystery of what gravity is. At the age of 26, Einstein made a startling discovery that the velocity of light is a kind of cosmic speed limit, a speed that nothing in the universe can exceed. But no sooner had the young Einstein published this idea than he found himself squaring off with the father of gravity. The trouble was, the idea that nothing can go faster than the speed of light flew in the face of Newton's picture of gravity. To understand this conflict, we have to run a few experiments. And to begin with, let's create a cosmic catastrophe. Imagine that all of a sudden, and without any warning, the sun vaporizes and completely disappears. Now, let's replay that catastrophe and see what effect it would have on the planets according to Newton. Newton's theory predicts that with the destruction of the sun, the planets would immediately fly out of their orbits, careening off into space. In other words, Newton thought that gravity was a force that acts instantaneously across any distance, and so we would immediately feel the effect of the sun's destruction. But Einstein saw a big problem with Newton's theory. A problem that arose from his work with light. Einstein knew light doesn't travel instantaneously. In fact, it takes 8 minutes for the sun's rays to travel the 93 million miles to the Earth. And since he had shown that nothing, not even gravity, can travel faster than light, how could the Earth be released from orbit before the darkness resulting from the sun's disappearance reached our eyes? To the young upstart from the Swiss patent office, anything outrunning light was impossible. And that meant the 250-year-old Newtonian picture of gravity was wrong.
If Newton is wrong, then why do the planets stay out? Because remember, the triumph of Newton's equations come from the quest to understand the planets and the stars. In particular, the problem of why do the planets have the orbits that they do. And with Newton's equations, you can calculate the way that the planets will move. Einstein's got to resolve this dilemma.
In his late 20s, Einstein had to come up with a new picture of the universe in which gravity does not exceed the cosmic speed limit. Still working his day job in the patent office, Einstein embarked on a solitary quest to solve this mystery. After nearly 10 years of racking his brain, he found the answer in a new kind of unification.
Einstein came to think of the three dimensions of space and the single dimension of time as bound together in a single fabric of space-time. It was his hope that by understanding the geometry of this four-dimensional fabric of space-time, that he could simply talk about things moving along surfaces in this space-time fabric.
Like the surface of a trampoline, this unified fabric is warped and stretched by heavy objects like planets and stars. And it's this warping or curving of space-time that creates what we feel as gravity.
A planet like the Earth is kept in orbit not because the Sun reaches out and instantaneously grabs hold of it, as Newton's theory, but simply because it follows curves in the spatial fabric caused by the Sun's presence. So, with this new understanding of gravity, let's rerun the cosmic catastrophe. Let's see what happens now if the Sun disappears. The gravitational disturbance that results will form a wave that travels across the spatial fabric in much the same way that a pebble dropped into a pond makes ripples that travel across the surface of the water. So we wouldn't feel a change in our orbit around the Sun until this wave reached the Earth. What's more, Einstein calculated that these ripples of gravity travel at exactly the speed of light. And so, with this new approach, Einstein resolved the conflict with Newton over how fast gravity travels. And more than that, Einstein gave the world a new picture for what the force of gravity actually is. It's warps and curves in the fabric of space and time. Einstein called this new picture of gravity general relativity. And within a few short years, Albert Einstein became a household name.
Einstein was like a rock star in his day. He was one of the most widely known and recognizable figures alive. He and perhaps Charlie Chaplin were the reigning kings of the popular media.
People followed his work, and they were anticipating, because of this wonderful thing he had done with general relativity, this recasting the laws of gravity out of his head. There was the thought he could do it again, and they, you know, people want to be in on that.
Despite all that he had achieved, Einstein wasn't satisfied.
We're not going to watch that. Hopefully you can hear that. I say hopefully. Now comes the tricky part. That got to go back, right? There we are. All right, I'm back. Thanks. Okay, so I hope you picked up on what... If you didn't hear that, we can certainly play it for you again later. Basically, here's the problem. Newton says, there's gravity. And that's how we all walk on the ground and things like that. And part of that is the spinning of the Earth. Part of that is the magnetic force of the Sun. And then along comes Einstein a couple of years later and says, no, that's not true, because the most important thing in all the world is light. And if we look at Genesis 1, we might certainly reach that conclusion that in the beginning, let's go back here to Genesis 1, in verse 3, God said, let there be light, and there was light. According to Einstein, that is the primary or the premier thing in all the universe. Light, nothing can travel faster than light. And of course, Newton disagrees. So to get around that point, to get around that idea, Einstein creates the theory that the planets aren't just floating out there, but rather they're resting on something. That they're actually sitting, if you will, on a fabric or whatever, and they just spin around like this. And since the Earth is heavier, you create kind of this like centrifugal force, and therefore everything is the way it is. It's a very interesting idea. And while we want to look a little bit at our Bibles in that sense. First of all, I want to stay in Genesis 1, and I want you to skip on down to the fourth day, and we're briefly going to look at this, in verse 14, where God says, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons, for days and for years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also, and God set them in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. Now, that's an interesting, you've read that before, no doubt, and seeing what's going on there. However, when you stop and look here about what the implications of that of those verses are, it becomes rather hard to imagine. Look over at Job 38, which is kind of the parallel to what's going on here. Because what's going on is important to what we just saw these two gentlemen talk about in terms of the planets. Job 38, and we're going to pick this up you're talking to Job, of course. Well, we'll begin from the beginning. Verse 1. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof? If thou knowest, or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning star sang together, and the sons of God shouted for joy.'" So he's laying foundations in the heavens. And what he's really doing, if you look at Genesis 1, is that God is creating the planets, the stars, and he's placing them in the universe. Very precisely, by the way. Now, you saw that in the video. What they were saying is that if you follow the calculations, and this is true of the space program, if you follow the calculations of what Sir Isaac Newton put down, everything is precise. So therefore, you could send rockets up in the sky, and you can, because you know how everything's going to work. You look up and you see the orbit and you see things like that. That's all well and good. But when you stop and think about it, God is creating something over here, and now he's putting it over here. And he does this in Genesis 1 quite a bit, actually. Takes the man, creates him over here, and places him over here. He does that with the woman, too. He takes the rib, takes the woman away from the garden, away from Adam's sight, and then brings him back and presents him to Adam. This pattern shows up very early, and I suggest you're going to see this pattern show up throughout our Bibles. This idea of placing. Now, back to a little bit about Einstein and his idea that planets float on a surface, if you will. They circle around. That's interesting, because if we read here in 38 of Job, we see that they're talking about foundations and laying thing in place as though everything had structure, and it does. This is a really important point that we want to consider here for just a moment. I'll suggest to you, and we'll look at this maybe later, that when God set his plan in motion, and he says, I want seeds, I want animals, I want sun, moon, and stars, you say, well, God is creating this so that the man can dwell there. But I'm also suggesting to you that God called it very good because he could also walk through this earth as well. It was comfortable for him, too. It's something he was happy to be around because God is a God of structure. So when we are later going to talk about things like heaven, I'll suggest to you that heaven is not just this nebulous thing that we think of, but that heaven has structure. God, and this was a big, this is a kind of a big revelation for me many, many years ago, because as a young person, when I used to think of the concept of God, I would think of light and color and, yeah, kind of like whatever. But God is a physical God. therefore he creates physical things around him, all out of his mind, out of his development of what he wants. It's hard to see. The reason he created us is for his pleasure, was it not? And it's we're physical beings because God is physical. And that concept leads you to believe that everything in the universe is physical. There is no void. There is no nothingness in that sense. Everything has structure. Everything has its place. And God has decided, and by the way, this is going to have implications later on, because what I'm telling you now about God putting everything in a certain place, in a certain orbit, in a certain thing, you're going to get challenged later on that point and say, how good do you feel about that point? But what I'm saying to you here is that what God has done is place everything. Now, we talked about this last night, and I'll allude to it again. It's bigger than that. He placed every one of us into the ecclesia. And so what he did is he took us out over here, and I could work with him, and brings us in the ecclesia and says, I'm going to place him right there. The same idea that he's doing in Genesis 1, he's doing even in our own spiritual walk. He says, I can create this person here and bring him here. And so now I'm going to work with this person. And guess what? After I'm done with this, when it's all said and done, I'm going to present this bride, this woman, and I'm going to place them in front of my son. And then they, in turn, are going to be placed into a kingdom to inhabit. And all of this is being done away from where he's going to do it. It's almost like a workshop in some ways. And it's a very hard thing, a concept to get around, this idea of what God is doing. God does things in hidden ways. It's as though he does something here so he can move it over there. And it's odd to our way of thinking, because we think, well, no, I'm working on something right in front of me. But his plan and purpose is such that he's got something here and he puts it in place over here. Now, this has big implications for us, by the way, in our own lives. Certainly in Jesus' life it did. It suggests to you, of course, that there isn't quite as much randomness as you might imagine in your life. So that when God is working with us, he has a purpose with us in everything in our daily lives. There's things he brings to us, if you will. You might call it trouble. He calls it working with us. You call it a trial. He says, nah, that's just molding you a little bit more. You know, that's the old story of the parent says, you know, eat your peas, it, you know, gives you character or whatever. But what he's doing, it's by design. This isn't by happenstance. This is like, how did I end up here? Part of it is you ended up there because of your thoughts. But the other part is the Lord saying, okay, it's time to bring this person back a bit more. Nothing in our world, if God is winding things up and just letting it go, he'd be doing that with us too, and he's not doing this. We looked last night, I'll never leave thee nor forsake thee. He's omnipresent. He's here now. He's here wherever you go. No matter where we are, he's always there. And so this idea that God, if you want to call it tinkering with the universe, I wouldn't know if I'd want to use that word, but he set up a structure and a design that we're going to look at more and more as we go along tomorrow. This concept of how the universe is laid out. For instance, the basic question you always hear, look at, well, where's heaven? You know, well, it's up there. No, where? Beyond the clouds. What does that mean? And we're going to look at that, because once you get an appreciation of where the Father is, what's going on, and why he's doing what he's doing, you begin to see what he's attempting to do in the end is bring, actually, the earth together with all creation. Bring us all together. But in order to do that, of course, he can't have, you know, sinful beings. Can't have that. That doesn't fit. So he has to work with us to get us to a place where the Father and the bride can meet, and then can now put them in a garden. And basically, what is he saying to the saints and to Christ? Fix this place. Fix this garden here. Things are out of control here. And that's exactly what Christ and the saints are going to do. Oh, we'll fix this all right. We're going to get rid of sin. We're going to make the fields look much better. We're going to take care of the garden, if you will, of the earth. Why? Because we're preparing it for the Lord, the Father himself, to come back again. The Father had no problem walking around on the earth in Genesis 1 and 2, and certainly he was with the man and woman. He had no problem with that because this was a good habitation for him. It wasn't perfect, but it was good. But he certainly couldn't come now. The Father himself could certainly not come through this particular planet. You'd say, no way, he's much too glorious. His eyes are too pure to look at something like this. And so the Father says, my son and his bride are going to go back into the garden, like we're going to talk about in Genesis 2, and they're going to fix everything. They're going to make things, they're going to dress and keep it, and they're going to fix it up for me. That's going to take 1,000 years, but he's going to regulate things. The reason we're going to do things, the reason people, you say, well, that's terrible, people are going to die in the kingdom. That's right, because we're getting this ready for the Father. That's his whole point. The Father can't come to the earth until his son and the bride take care of it. And when he comes back, guess what? He looks around and says, wow, this is very good. You've done a great job here. And that is really kind of a blueprint of where God is taking all this. His son is now on his right hand, and he's going to go back to meet his bride and fix everything. Just fix it and make it well. And once it's all done, now the Father can come down, and we're jumping now way back into Revelation, are we not? But he's actually really jumping into Genesis 2. He comes back, and he meets us, and he says, how are things going? Let me look. Very well. I'm very pleased to be here. This was the whole intent I had. From ruin to restoration, I've taken something that was in total disrepair, and now I have a place, my resting place can be here on earth. That's what he's trying to accomplish in us. And so as we go through this whole idea of Genesis 1 and 2, I want you to see a kind of a lofty concept here. There's much bigger things going on in Genesis, the first couple chapters of Genesis, than just a creation. He's talking about us, he's talking about Christ, he's talking about what he wants, the pleasure he takes. And so I hope that maybe when you we go through this class, and by the way, tomorrow we're going to look at day two, because day two is the day that God said, I don't see it as very good. But it was necessary, as we'll see. But it still wasn't what God said, wow, I really like doing what I did on day two. So I would encourage you to read these two chapters, especially with the light of that particular thing. So look at those, and Lord willing, tomorrow we're going to go diving into day two on the creation of the firmament, which is, I think, a really interesting subject. So we'll stop there. I'm a little bit over here.